Good morning. I'll begin by eschewing any, temptation to open up with a sort of Denny Law-inspired story, as Wendell is apt to do from time to time, or a Greg Weaver-esque diatribe, or even some sort of over-the-top safety slides about how to safely run someone over with your car, or run a bicyclist over with your car. Sorry, not just anyone, bicyclist. And I'll forego all possible humor and entertainment as a gift to Wendell and as a peace offering for writing such creative things about him in the bulletin while he's gone, and vowing to do that every time he goes away on vacation or sabbatical in the future. So just go right into our message this morning. I think you'll find what we have to talk about for the next couple weeks very interesting and very timely as well. Wendell and I have material for you that ranges over different areas of concern, from biblical criticism, apologetics, history, and various facets of theology. And as he will know, as Wendell will note, when he comes up to speak, my comments will just serve to be as an introduction, and I'll try to keep them brief. We could easily spend months on this topic, just exploring all the different, the deep recesses of all that's entailed by what we'll talk about, as it's been a concern for Christians for centuries, and is even perhaps more pressing today than it has been in the past. I'll be taking all of next Sunday, as Wendell said, to supplement his teaching and explore an alternative explanation to what he proposes. Before I detail what it is that we'll be talking about in the specific biblical passages that we'll examine in our consideration, let me read to you just several recent publicized remarks made in light of what we'll be discussing this morning. In his book, A Farewell to God, the atheist Charles Templeton muses, "The God of the Old Testament is utterly unlike the God believed in by most practicing Christians. His justice, by modern standards, outrageous. He is biased, querulous, vindictive, and jealous of his prerogatives." During a recent debate with our good friend Dr. William Lane Craig, who we mentioned this morning, at Notre Dame, Sam Harris describes Yahweh as the Iron Age God of War and perfectly fond of genocide and slavery and human sacrifice. The agnostic thinker Robert Anton Wilson writes, "The Bible tells us to be like God, and then on page after page, it describes him as a mass murderer." And lastly, in his book, The God Delusion, our favorite thinker, Richard Dawkins, the ever-loquacious and prudent scientist, remarks, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." Now, what on earth could prompt these men to get their collective knickers in such a twist? What subject could be so provocative and emotion-laden that these otherwise dignified authors run out of pejorative adjectives to describe the God of the Bible? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal, at least to a large degree, it seems to us, is that the biblical passages that chronicle the God-initiated campaign for Israel to wage war upon the Canaanites and drive them out of the Promised Land. As most of you undoubtedly learned in Sunday school, the region of Judea, Palestine, Canaan, whatever you want to call it, was promised by God as inheritance for the descendants of Abraham, the Jewish people. This inheritance was to be taken by force, as Deuteronomy, Joshua, and subsequent books of the Old Testament describe in detail. Not surprisingly, outrage regarding the conquest narratives of the Old Testament is not just confined to militant atheists and aggrieved and embittered Canaanite ancestors. Though there are relatively few biblical scholars plying their trade around the world today, that is, accredited biblical scholars, their numbers magically and mystically swell in certain circumstances. Those who previously mocked and disregarded the Old and New Testaments as unreliable and as being reserved for idiots suddenly become the Scripture's most unflinching supporters. When a person feels that he's being unfairly criticized, guess what comes out? He'll begin an immediate public exegesis of the verse found somewhere in the Bible about not judging and not casting stones, lest his accuser be judged and stoned. When someone else wants to rebuke the proponent of something like just war theory and capital punishment for his insatiable bloodlust and hatred for all humanity, the teaching of Jesus about turning the other cheek is invoked in a triumphal and smug manner. And when the agnostic wants to draw parallels between the violence of Islam and the God of the Bible, he'll cite the Spanish Inquisition, the Crusades, and that one part in the one place, in the one section of the Old Testament where God kills millions of innocent people. Despite making light of the ways in which their concern is articulated, the unbeliever's concern, and even Christians' concern to some degree, the objection is one that needs attention. Namely, how can such seemingly violent passages in Scripture that call for the eradication of an entire people group be reconciled with the loving, patient, and compassionate picture of God that we get from the rest of the Bible? Words like genocide, murder, and phrases like ethnic cleansing are all very contentious ways to speak of God's actions, obviously. Detractors use such extreme terms for specific reasons, but their patent disdain for our Lord should prompt us to take their criticism seriously. In my own interaction with both believers and unbelievers, this topic seems to come up with such a high degree of frequency. I see it as such a pressing matter that it was one of the first lectures that I gave upon being hired here almost a year and a half ago to the kids on Wednesday night. It wouldn't be hard to imagine that most of you have had conversations with your friends, family, coworkers, and others about the difficulties that these warfare passages pose for Christianity and for us as Christians. I can recall several arguments with an agnostic friend recently of mine who found the Christian worldview indefensible in light of these particular verses that we'll examine this morning. If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that squaring what we know to be true about God's character, the things that we read about in the slides during our offering time, the things that we meditate upon, especially in the New Testament, we'll admit that squaring what we know to be true about God's character with these problematic commands that we'll examine to the Israelites is not an easy issue to remedy. In fact, there are legitimate concerns raised by the skeptic that we've probably had ourselves at one time or another. This is the reason we're taking 2 solid weeks to think critically about how to deal and how to best respond to this topic. Though the details of Israel's escape from Egypt and subsequent military action in Canaan are scattered over numerous books of the Old Testament, there are a few key verses in both Deuteronomy and Joshua that warrant special attention and can make clear what the problem is. So what is the problem? Well, let's look at a couple sets of verses. Moses, speaking to the Israelites before they embarked upon their campaign to take the land of Canaan, in Deuteronomy 7:1-2 says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, 7 nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy." Later, after Moses had described the rules of warfare when confronting enemies outside the Promised Land, there were two distinct sets of commands given to the Israelites before they engaged in conquest. They were to deal with the nations outside of Palestine, outside of Judea, in one fashion, and differently when inside the Promised Land. So Moses is describing these new rules for confronting the new enemy in the Promised Land. He prescribes different conduct when engaging the inhabitants of Canaan. Deuteronomy 20:16-17. "However, in the cities of the nation the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave anything alive that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you." Joshua 6:21, Joshua 8:24-26, and other related verses describe the Israelite battles against the Canaanites when they happen, with similar language to that of Deuteronomy. So obviously in Deuteronomy, Moses is speaking, and in Joshua, they're describing the events sort of in real time. Joshua speaks of the Jews as devoting all in the city to destruction when talking about Jericho, and killing all the inhabitants of Ai in describing the taking of that city. So did God really command the Israelites to wipe people made in his image off the face of the earth? Some other questions to be addressed. Do the Old Testament texts accurately reflect real military history? If we're unsure about these warfare accounts, can we be sure about other parts of Scripture? We can understand God telling the Israelites to fight against soldiers from other nations, but what about women and children that are included in this? Is Christianity, like Islam, an intrinsically violent religion? Other questions that may come to your mind. As we begin this discussion about how to contextualize these passages properly and how to think wisely through them, we have to keep in mind exactly what's at stake on one side or the other. First, we must avoid the trap of being too emotionally involved in the issue. The gentlemen whom I quoted earlier were obviously so bent out of shape about this topic that they couldn't ponder it responsibly. I like to call this the Lifetime movie syndrome. And this is where, I don't know if you've ever watched a Lifetime movie, almost every character in the movie is designed to emotionally manipulate and get bent out of shape. I don't know, maybe that's just a characterization I have. But the point being that we have to be, perhaps unlike the critic, willing to take methodical steps in working through this. There is nothing about this area of study that should threaten to derail your faith in God or anything of the sort. It is just not... it is an important, but it is not as critical as perhaps the critic may make it out to be. The absolute worst case scenario for us is that there is an inconsistency in affirming both the goodness of God and the historical reliability of the Old Testament narratives. But what follows from that inconsistency? That's the question that needs to be asked. The existence of God isn't challenged in this instance. The resurrection and dual nature of Christ aren't debunked. And the sinfulness of man is uncontested. Notice that absolutely no center circle doctrine is included in this discussion. No center circle doctrine is at stake. You'll remember our concentric circles about things that make us essentially Christian being at the center of the most center circle. None of those issues are at stake in this discussion. The complaint against these passages is nowhere near an argument against the existence of God. As I'll contend next week, this is an internal issue for Christianity to deal with. So even if every one of the skeptics' criticisms are true, then perhaps we'll have to interpret the verses as legendary or indicating a misinterpretation of the commands on Israel's part. Wendell and I will show that most of the concerns surrounding the conquest accounts evaporate upon closer inspection. But until then, bear in mind that this is not the earth-shattering disproof of Christianity that some think it to be. Next week, I'll explore the theological implications of taking these commands literally and further discuss the historical setting in which they were given. Far from revealing a God of hate, partiality, corruption, and death, we'll consider some excellent evidence that the loving and long-suffering God of the New Testament is the same being depicted in the pages of the Old Testament. Taking the commands literally is only one of a couple popular options we could take when reconciling these verses to the character of God. Wendell will tell you about the merits of interpreting the warfare passages in a hyperbolic manner today, and I will explore the alternative next Sunday. Until then, let me leave you with a couple of thoughts that have their roots in C.S. Lewis. As I discussed with the youth group when we did lectures about the strangeness or the perceived weirdness of many Old Testament laws, such as not mixing particular fibers together or not trimming the edges of your beard or various things like that, we must not be guilty of what C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery. Perhaps you've heard that phrase before. As the book of Hebrews makes abundantly clear, the Old Testament was riddled with less than ideal circumstances, confronting a less than ideal people, trying to abide by less than ideal laws. Israel lived in an environment that is totally foreign in nearly every way to the situation that we live in today. We must not assume that certain courses of action are intrinsically barbaric or subhuman just because we can't get our pampered, desensitized Western minds around them. As I'll argue next week, we have eradicated the justice of God in our eagerness to make him more palatable for evangelism and for our own lives. We cannot fathom that he would wrathfully judge nations, including the Canaanites, since we view him as a heavenly wish dispenser and kindly old man. Secondly, the last thought to leave you with from C.S. Lewis. We ought not to let areas of doubt trump what we know to be true about God. God has answered an unfathomable amount of questions that we have put to him about himself and left us in the dark about very few important things. He has proven his faithfulness and kept his promises time and time again. We trust God because he is completely trustworthy. In areas that are unclear to us regarding God's motives or actions, we absolutely must give him the benefit of the doubt. He has earned it, and we cannot emphasize enough how limited our perspective and wisdom in comparison to his are. As Lewis points out, if a trusted friend pledges to meet you somewhere and fails to show up on time, which of us would not feel slightly ashamed if one moment after we had given him up, he arrived with a full explanation of his delay? We should feel as if we ought to know him better. And so is the case with God.
All right, well, as Nate has already explained, there's a number of different ways to address this question when it comes up. And ideally, each one of us would be adequately equipped to take a critic or a skeptic or someone with just honest questions through all the various points and subpoints to present a complete and satisfying answer, one that would be both theologically sound and also consistent with what the Bible passages actually say. However, like so many subjects relating to apologetics, you know, we are often exposed to a good argument on this or that, one that addresses the possible loopholes and presents what appears to be a convincing, airtight case. And then we find ourselves 5 months later in a conversation where we need that information and, you know, we can't remember everything and then we end up kind of stumbling through it. Anyone been through something like that? I think we all have. The genocide question is a lot like that. It doesn't come up every day, and so we're not all that rehearsed on it, but it does come up, and you can expect it to come up. And there are a number of these pesky little what about this type questions that can present a bit of a challenge. And so our objective here today and next week is we're just going to make it pretty simple. We want to introduce you to two main arguments or points that put the genocide question in its right perspective. And these points are easy to remember, they're easy to understand, they're easy to explain to others. And it's not going to be our intention here to give this subject an exhaustive or comprehensive treatment. We want to keep things simple and manageable because, again, this could take several weeks, if not months. When it comes to the various subpoints and supporting information that we will be presenting, if you find yourself in a conversation with an unbeliever and you can't remember everything, then sometimes, as we have taught here in the past, the best response is simply, that's a good question. It deserves a good answer. My memory at the moment is failing me on this point, so let me look into it and I'll get back with you. That's perfectly acceptable, and we encourage you to take that route as opposed to trying to wing it and making things worse. Basically, our main objective today and next week is to leave you with a certain confidence that there is a satisfying answer to this genocide question. The new atheists like to think that they have driven a spear through the heart of Christianity, but as you will see, they haven't. And so we simply ask that you follow along, take the effort to remember the two main points, understand them, be able to explain the basic principles behind them to anyone who might ask you about genocide in the Old Testament. And that's simply our goal for today and next week. Simple, manageable, pretty easy. Anyone who's interested in pursuing the matter further will find a number of helpful books on the subject that are readily available. What I will be sharing today comes from the research and teachings of Dr. Paul Copan. He's also a well-known apologist, and he has written extensively on this subject in various journals and magazine articles and books, including his own book, Is God a Moral Monster? All right, so let's get into it. Let me give you the heads up now. It looks like we're going to be running a little long today, so make yourself comfortable. And again, you had that extra hour of sleep, so I assume that you'll be refreshed and be able to stay alert and stay with us. The two main arguments could be spelled out something like this, and I'll show them on the screen in a moment. And actually, this is the way that I've characterized it, because I wanted to frame it around two questions. First is, because the Canaanites were so morally depraved and evil to the extreme, guilty of the most perverse sins possible, and because they aggressively sought to morally corrupt all other civilizations, including the Jews, and aggressively sought to conquer all other peoples militarily, God was justified in ordering their destruction. This is basically the capital punishment argument. It was limited to a select group of people during a specific time in history and was not a standing order. Any act on the part of Israel to attack the Canaanites or other similar groups was the response to a direct command from God. Now, there's a lot to all of this. It deals more with the theological side of the case, tackling issues like God's holiness and justice, God's right as the moral lawgiver to punish sin, even by death and war, his eternal purposes in showing mercy to some nations and not showing mercy to others, the threat of sin and its corrupting influence upon mankind, and on and on. In our extremely tolerant age, as Nate noted, people tend to be quite uncomfortable with the subject of God's wrath, but this is something that we cannot shy away from and still be true to the gospel. In fact, the gospel would not be the gospel unless God punished sinners for their transgressions. And this, of course, is what makes the cross of Christ so rich and beautiful and wonderful. He was punished on our behalf. But the fact remains, God is the moral lawgiver. He expects his laws to be obeyed. And though he is quite patient with those who continue to sin, there comes a point in which the evil becomes so great that he will intervene and bring fierce and decisive judgment upon the wicked. And again, next week, Nate will be presenting this side of the argument, which again tends to be more of the theological one. The second argument, the one that I want to develop today, tackles the question from more of the hermeneutical side of things. That is, it deals more with how we are to correctly interpret the various passages that record these commands to wipe out the Canaanites and the passages that report what happened. As we will see, things are not exactly what they appear to be. And so, to point you to these two points here on the screen, if the skeptic or inquisitor asks, if God is so good, why would he command Israel to engage in ethnic cleansing and genocidal warfare against their enemies? Well, we have two different responses, each in the form of a question that opens up the door for all sorts of in-depth discussion. What would be wrong with that? Would be one question. And as you can see, any answer that they give will inevitably set up their own trap, for they will have to admit to a universal morality that all humans are expected to live by. And this, of course, opens up the door for a moral lawgiver, God himself. And we saw this actually in full living color in the debate between Christopher Hitchens and Douglas Wilson last year during one of our movie nights. But the question, what would be wrong with that, also sets up other avenues that can be explored as well, such as sin itself and issues of justice and God's right to punish sin and so much more. And again, Nate, he'll fill our plate up with this next week. The other question, which I want to work us through this morning and also puts things in perspective, is this. What makes you think that even happened? Ethnic cleansing? Genocidal warfare? Massive annihilation? Really? Are you sure about that? How can you be so sure? So let's dive into it. As one digs into the Old Testament, it seems that much of what we learned as children in Sunday school about the wars against the Canaanites and their destruction and other similar enemies has been, how do I put it, perhaps less than accurate. In fact, if we take certain passages at face value that describes specific military conquests that Israel experienced, if we take it at face value, we run into all sorts of problems. What is said in one passage contradicts what is said in another, that is, if read and understood in the traditional ways. There are many examples of this. Take this one from Numbers 31. Because their women seduced the men of Israel, causing them to fall into both sexual sin and idolatry, God ordered Moses to punish the Midianites. And so a large army of 12,000 soldiers, 1,000 from each tribe, advance against Midian. And in verse 7, we are told that they killed every man. And a few verses later, we see that they were also ordered to go back and kill every boy as well, and every woman who had seduced the men of Israel. And those remaining, whoever would be left, at this point would just be the virgins, were taken to be captive. Pretty harsh stuff here. Now, I'm in no way questioning whether God was justified in commanding such a thing. Certainly, he would be justified. But I do have to wonder if this punishment that Israel brought to bear upon the Midianites was as harsh as it actually sounds. And here's why. We have all heard about the Midianites from childhood, but we remember them not from this account in Numbers 31, but from what book? The book of Judges, from something that happened a few years later. And what would that be? What's the story? Gideon, remember that? In his fearless army of just 300 men? And who did they prepare themselves to face in battle? The Midianites. In fact, there were so many Midianites, as you can see here in chapter 6, that their tents were like a swarm of locusts, and that it was impossible to even count their men and camels. And so the question is, where did they come from? Given the fact that Israel, quote, killed every man and went back to kill all the boys, and no women were left to have babies because they were killed or taken captive. This is but one of many examples in the Old Testament where God appears to have ordered the absolute destruction of a people, only to find out that somehow they reappear later on. And not just survive, but are thriving to the point of being a threat to Israel yet again. Here's another example. The 11th chapter of Joshua reports a great conspiracy involving a large number of Israel's enemies planning a once-for-all battle to wipe God's people off the face of the earth. The Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Hivites, they all form an alliance to march out against Israel to destroy them. Though greatly outnumbered, Joshua's army defeated them to the point where we read in verse 8, he defeated this great alliance where no survivors were left. And in verse 12, he totally destroyed them, not sparing anyone that breathed. In verse 14, all the people were put to the sword. Yet, later on, we find Israel contending with many of these same armies again. Either they weren't destroyed and annihilated, or either they were destroyed and annihilated, or they weren't. The question is, which is it? For instance, years later, King Saul had to contend with the Amorites. In the book of Judges, the Jebusites reappear. The first two chapters of Judges, as you know, report swarms of Canaanites remaining after Joshua had supposedly left no survivors, and so on. Now, what are we to make of this? As we go on into here in the same chapter, chapter 11, we read that after Joshua defeats this great alliance, he immediately takes his army up to the hill country and destroys the Anakites, even destroying their towns. And yet, three chapters later, Caleb asks permission to drive out the Anakites from the same hill country. In all these examples, we were left wondering, were these people destroyed or not? If not, then why does the Bible say that they were? And this is where we actually look now into the art and science of Bible interpretation. Hermeneutics, one of our favorite disciplines here. And the first rule to correctly understanding any passage is to ask yourself, what did the original author actually intend to convey, and how did the original readers understand what he said? It's going to be God's word to us. It first has to be God's word to them. So we have to keep in mind, again, as Nate pointed out, that we are separated here by thousands of years, thousands of miles, separated by differences in language, writing styles, and even, very important, standards by what would be considered acceptable reporting of history. And therefore, while most of the Bible can be understood on face value, there are some passages that take a little bit more work, because there may be other things going on, figures of speech that we may not be familiar with, and idioms, and so forth, that need to be taken into account. And we've talked about this sort of thing actually in the past here quite a bit, and anyone who's been through the book Knowing Scripture will be familiar with this whole concept. What we have here in these Old Testament warfare narratives are classic examples of hyperbole and overstatement. When it comes to the reporting of triumphant battles and the whole business of marching into war, the Bible writers often incorporated highly figurative language, which was actually a common practice in the ancient world. the enemy would be presented as some sort of unbeatable foe. His armies would outnumber the sand of the sea. The tents would be like swarms of locusts. The conquest of the underdog then would be reported as wiping them, in contrast, wiping them off the face of the earth, leaving no survivors, killing every breathing thing. Exaggeration for rhetorical effect. The language is spiced up for the major, spiced up with a measure of boasting and even some bravado. Now, we all recognize this sort of thing in the way that we ourselves talk about similar things involving victory and defeat, like, you know, competition, sporting events, and even elections. A boxer going into the ring promises to leave his opponent crippled for life. The media will present a landslide election as the incumbent blew his challenger away. You know, really? You know, we are all accustomed to certain terms and expressions in competitive settings that say one thing, but something else is obviously meant. We will slaughter them. We will eat them for lunch. We will leave them bankrupt and destitute, crying for mercy, and we will show them none. That kind of thing. However, now, we may find this kind of hyperbolic language strange for something like a historical narrative. After all, today, our history books tend to go out of the way to avoid that kind of thing. Or, for that matter, figures of speech of any kind. They tend to be much more sterile when it comes to that. But this was not the case in the ancient Near Eastern world. Again, a different writing standard. In fact, archaeologists have discovered the same warfare bravado in non-biblical writings of the same time period. And many examples here could be given. One we have is that a Moabite king wrote of his defeat of Israel. He reports it as, "Israel is no more. Israel has utterly perished forever." You know, really? Seriously? Again, Copan lists a number of these examples. And again, they are taken from non-biblical sources of that same time period. And so, the bottom line here is basically this. Joshua's military campaign in Canaan, for instance, wasn't an ethnic cleansing or a genocide. There was no massive annihilation. This was simply a series of disabling raids. Such exaggerated language is actually abundant in the Old Testament. Even when a passage speaks of such large numbers in a given army, sometimes over 200,000, one has to at least wonder if this isn't a bit over the top. For armies of that size, as historians have pointed out, would be quite unlikely in the Near Eastern world in ancient times. And so one possibility here is that there is some hyperbole going on. Now, that doesn't mean that the passage is in error. That would be true if the original readers had been misled. But if this exaggerated language in regards to battles was the accepted standard of the day, and numbers in a context like this were not expected to be mathematically precise, then the original readers would have understood that an army of 200,000 would simply mean an army so large that nobody could possibly take them on. Let me give you a simple illustration that we could all relate to. I probably don't need to give an illustration, but Denny's been on me about adding more stories and illustrations and personal anecdotes and that sort of thing in my sermons. So I'm working this in. On Wednesdays, Denny, Nate, and I go to lunch together almost every week, and let's say, for the sake of the example, that Nate always forgets his wallet and he always has to borrow $6 or $7 from me every time, and that Denny does the same thing. And this goes on for over a year. Now, granted, you would think that I would just wise up and eventually say no, but given the fact, as you know, that I'm such a kind and benevolent and generous person, hesitant to tell people no to anything, that I would just keep buying their lunch time and time again. Now, after a year or so of this, let's say that I make a passing comment to John Nelson that lunch with Nate and Denny is sending me into bankruptcy, and that I've spent a good $10,000 this past year from buying meals on Wednesdays. Now, let's say that somehow this statement gets written down, is buried away and forgotten about, and then surfaces 800 years from now. Anyone in the future reading what I said may think nothing of it at first, unless, of course, they do their research and learn about the spending power of $10,000 in this culture, this time period. And they would find out that it's quite unlikely that I would rack up that much in lunch money. here in the early part of the 21st century in the Midwest, especially what they did more research and found that this would be on in Wayndale. You would never get $10,000 worth of expenses in low-end restaurants here in Wayndale. And the people 800 years from now would either conclude that this Wendell guy was factually wrong with his numbers, or that this Wendell guy was exaggerating to emphasize how much he had been taken advantage of. And if the researcher looked at the way we communicate in this time period, in this culture, he would find that we exaggerate all the time for effect. And so in the Old Testament, when we are given numbers of people killed or numbers of people in a marching army, it is possible, I'm not claiming anything here other than the possibility, that the numbers have been purposely inflated for rhetorical effect, and that the original readers understood this and took the meaning to be it was a lot, an exceptionally large number of people. Along this line, we can safely conclude that the Old Testament writers themselves recognized their account of no survivor was left in one chapter, and then writing about surviving hostiles in a chapter or two later on. They were not mindless. They knew what they were doing. But they saw no problem with affirming both side by side. And again, the original readers would not have had any problem with this either, because they understood the standard of that day in this. In fact, we could go so far to say that Moses himself, a man of his times, did not intend a literal, all-encompassing extermination of the Canaanites when he issued such commands. His language also is an example of this ancient Near Eastern exaggeration when it comes to military action. And in fact, you need not look any further than the fact that we sometimes find Moses commanding Israel to destroy the Canaanites, and then other times commanding Israel to drive them out of the land. And so how can it be both? It's going to be one or the other. Again, the goal was not annihilation, but expulsion, even when language of annihilation was used. In fact, this exaggeration even extends to language involving women and children. There is a compelling case to be made, which we don't have time for this morning, that common expressions like all and young and old and men and women were also part of this rhetorical language commonly used to emphasize utter defeat and utter conquest, and don't actually refer to the mass killing of innocent, helpless people. In fact, we find examples of Israel going out to defeat a particular town, being told to destroy every man, woman, and child, and the town was not a village full of homes and markets and playgrounds, but rather a military outpost where women and children would not even be present. But again, the language was used to emphasize the degree to which the enemy was to be beaten back. Again, let's think of a high school basketball team that might promise to the, you know, at the pep rally the day before, to the degree, you know, before the big game, they say, you know, we're going to eat their opponents alive, including their cheerleaders and classmates and teachers and even the school principal. And we're not going to stop there. We're going to take down their families and pets and even goldfish. You know, they're all gone down. You know, it's an all-encompassing language for the effect. Now, whether this is so in every single case or not in the Old Testament, where women and children are named, isn't exactly clear. And we might want to be a little careful how hard we push that. But Copan actually makes a very good argument for it nonetheless, and it is certainly a possibility. But even if women and children were killed in battle, we would have reason to believe that they were combatants on the battlefields themselves and not helpless victims hiding under their beds. Again, keep in mind the objective here was not mass slaughter of the Canaanites, but the driving them out of the land. It was an elimination of their sexually perverted, bloodthirsty, idolatrous religion and child sacrifices, which threatened not only Israel itself, morally and militarily, but all nations. And Israel itself was under the same very threat. If it fell into the same sexual perversion and idolatry, they too would be driven out in like manner. Finally, it needs to be pointed out that such military action against the Canaanites and other specified enemies was the last resort and could have been avoided if such enemies repented from their wickedness and entered into peace treaties with Israel. And this is a whole subject in itself, one that Nate will probably explore next week. But regardless, we do need to keep in mind that Israel could only attack an enemy if God specifically commanded it, Kings and tribal leaders and high priests could not call for a war, only a prophet through divine revelation. There was no standing army to annihilate all of Israel's enemies. In fact, God did not even allow them to have a standing army. There were no professional soldiers, only amateurs and volunteers who were called to serve when the situation called for it. And their service in wartime was not compensated for with any salary, not even in the taking of personal plunder. So to wrap this up, let me return to the original question that the skeptic might ask. If your God is so good, then why did he command Israel to wipe his enemies off the face of the earth? You know, this is their gotcha moment. But the fact is, the critic or skeptic has to go on to explain why it is that these enemies continue to not only live and survive, but sometimes even thrive, and thrive to the point of becoming a threat to Israel yet again. Virtually every command, or virtually every time a narration of mass killing occurs, it is followed up by an account that presupposes that it actually did not happen. And indeed, based on archaeology and historical findings of that time period, along with the biblical text, the conclusion is that it didn't happen. There were battles. There were wars. People did die, for sure. Lots of people. But again, these battles were more like disabling raids that targeted military strongholds rather than savage conquests of utter destruction, killing every man, woman, and child, wiping out every last living soul. The purpose was to dry them out, subdue them, neutralize their military power and influence, beat them back. So again, very important, what is in view here is expulsion, not annihilation. All right, next week, Nate will continue on with part two of this, addressing the theological side of the argument. And here we will deal more with the level of wickedness found among the Canaanites and other enemies of Israel, and God's righteous and just decree to punish sin, including the use of war and bringing about such punishment. I mean, even for the sake of the argument, there was mass killing. The question remains, as presented earlier, well, you know, what exactly would be wrong with that? Especially in light of the fact that God's mercy has been patiently extended for long periods of time, that people would accept his mercy and not consistently reject it. All right, let's have the Sunday school kids come in.